Welcome back to Season 4 of the Gastronauts Podcast. This season, we will be releasing new episodes featuring interviews with gut brain scientists from around the world on the second Tuesday of every month. On the fourth Tuesday of every month, we will release previously recorded Q&A sessions from last year's Gastronauts presentations. I'll be the host of these previously recorded episodes, but I'm really excited to introduce the new host of the Gastronauts Podcast, Emily Allway.
Hi, Peter. Thanks for the introduction, and it's great to be here. We are very excited to share this new season with you, starting with today's episode featuring Dr. Temple Grandin and Dr. Andrew Huberman. If you have questions about gut brain science, please share them with us at Gut Brain Matters on Twitter and Instagram. We may even feature your questions on an episode this season.
If you've ever eaten beef or thought about how we treat cattle, you have Dr. Temple Grandin to thank. Dr. Temple Grandin is a professor of animal science at Colorado State University. She has championed efforts to improve animal welfare, and her designs on how to handle cattle have been implemented in half of the facilities in the United States. However, she didn't just stop with revolutionizing the cattle industry. She has leveraged her unique insights into animal behavior and her personal experiences with autism to become the leading spokesperson for autism spectrum disorders. She has co-authored numerous books on both her experiences with autism, as well as how to develop new mindsets to help kids with autism spectrum disorder. And HBO has produced a wonderful film based on her life story. And we are so incredibly excited to have her share some of her perspectives with us today.
The thing about autistic kids, let's just talk about the fully verbal end of the spectrum, who range from Elon Musk, who I always thought he was autistic. This is Ashley Vance's book. I marked it up like 5 or 6 years ago, and now I know he's autistic. You may not be able to dress themselves. But the thing I want to emphasize is the importance of developing strengths. I had ability in art, and that showed up when I was 8 years old, and that was always encouraged. Another kid might have ability in math, and then that needs to be encouraged, or an ability in foreign languages or music. And one of the worst things schools have done is taken out hands-on classes. Those classes are just so important, because how could you find out you could play a musical instrument if you never had a chance to even try one? So there's three kinds of minds. And I actually talk about the different minds in my book on the autistic brain. I present the science that there's an object visualizer like me who thinks completely in pictures, sort of like PowerPoint slides coming up in my mind. And the HBO movie shows that perfectly. Then there's the mathematical pattern thinkers, and then there are the word thinkers. Now, being a visual thinker really helped me in my work with animals. And the very first work I did, I went out to the feedlots in Arizona, and I noticed if there was a shadow or a coat or something hung on a fence, they would stop. And nobody else was noticing that. Now, I didn't know at the time when I was in my 20s that a lot of other people think completely verbally. You know, now it's well known. This is well documented with science. The Autistic Brain book has got some of that science in there that shows our different kinds of thinking. There's also some people have no visual thinking at all. And a lot of so-called normal people are mixtures of the object visualizer, the math thinker, or the word thinker. And one of my students did an interesting experiment with a horse, and this might explain why horses sometimes just spook for no reason. Well, she trained young fillies and colts to walk by a children's playset that had a little colorful slide and swing. And when the playset got rotated 90 degrees, it turned into a new object. Now, just imagine if a stapler was 10 feet long. When you rotate it, it turns into a new object. And the horse reacted to it like a new object. A verbal thinker would think about that. Now, when you're kind of different, what I learned to do when you're kind of weird, you don't interview well, is to simply show off my work. So I've got to show off some of my drawings that I've gotten thinking in pictures. And when you're different, you know, the thing to do is to just show off your work. Now, the different kinds of minds have complementary skills. Okay, we're interested in scientific communication. Now, a lot of the science now, they're kind of equating rigor in science with the fanciest statistics test. When I see a multivariate analysis done on a 30 cattle experiment, I think it's kind of dumb. You don't have enough cattle to even take advantage of that package. And what's happening is the visual thinkers are getting screened out of science, and you need us. Because I reviewed a lot of scientific papers, and the part I review is the methods. Okay, you're interested in gut microbiome? Small differences in how a study is done can completely change the results. So I review a paper and I go, you didn't tell me what breed of cattle you had, what breed of pig you had, what did you feed them? How were they housed? These things can drastically affect the results of experiments. There was one famous case in an article that was called The Devil is in the Details, I think was the title of the article. And it was a cancer experiment. And the method that was used to stir the cancer cells totally changed the results. So it's important in your methods to write down exactly what stirring device you used. And it came from the such and such company and it was model such and such, because this makes a difference. I was just at a food conference, food safety conference, and I just saw a new stirring device. And that can totally change your experiments. And so being a visual thinker really helped me out. Can't emphasize enough on the importance of good teachers. Now, how do we get new scientific concepts out to the public? I was reading an interesting book that Cheryl Miller gave me for a birthday present on the history of science and sort of the development of the scientific method. And in the beginning of the development of science, it was just observation of things. Okay, you get a new tool like a microscope or a telescope that enables you to see things you couldn't see before, things like germs or something, one of the things that they could you could see. So we need to have both visual thinking and mathematical thinking in science. So how did I spread ideas on designing cattle handling facilities that some people thought were kind of far out? Well, I wrote about it in our local farm magazine, and there's a scene in the movie where I walk up to the editor of the magazine and I get his card, because I realized if I wrote for that magazine, that would really help my career. So that's our local magazine. Then I wrote for the national magazine, but I also put things in the scientific articles, because all the things I wrote in the 70s, pretty much, it's all pre-internet. I don't know what they've done with, you know, 1970s version of Beef magazine, but you certainly can't find it online. But you put things in the scientific press that preserves it. So it's important to communicate in both. And let's have part of the paper where it's free of jargon, where you just explain in the abstract why you did this experiment, what you found out from it. Okay, there'll be a statistics part of it that a lot of people will understand, but let's have some intro and some discussion to make it a bit more accessible. Like, for example, let's say cattle are cattle. We don't have to call them bovines, just because that sounds fancier. But I found on a lot of things I invented, and I have a video called Beef Plant Video Tour with Temple Grandin, and shows some of my systems and that big piece of equipment called the Centrotrack Restrainer System. I found that successful transferring of the technology took more time than inventing the technology, because you had to make sure that the second plant that put it in didn't modify it and do something stupid with it. And that's exactly what happened. You also, when you're introducing something new, when I chose my first plant to put in the Centrotrack Restrainer, and I actually have an article in Applied Animal Behavior Science on this, you got to pick an early adopter that wants to make the thing work, whatever that thing is, wants to make it work. And then I had to go to the startups of the next six plants and fix dumb things they did to it, because the second plant changed the design of it and it would have failed if I hadn't been there to correct their problem with a piece of cardboard. It's amazing how behavior can control cattle. I laid a piece of cardboard across the top of the chute and they just calmed right down with a piece of cardboard with duct tape. They could have touched it, knocked it off. That's the power of behavior. So make sure with new things, your early adopters don't fail. They want to make the thing work, publicized in the regular press, on the internet now, all the things we now have for the internet, scientific articles. And you're going to spend more time transferring the technology. And the other thing is, don't overstate the case. Don't say that this is going to totally change your life if you do this thing. Only claim I'm going to make is that when you operate my equipment correctly, cattle are going to stay calm and move really easily. Probably have a less stress, which has a good effect on meat quality. You don't tell them it's going to remake their business. That's overselling a job. I learned a long time ago not to do that. And the other thing is, whatever your new technology is or your new science is, sell your own product. Don't be bashing the competition all the time. Work on selling your own product and just doing it in a real factual, straightforward way in a lot of different channels. And I'm getting to the end of my time and I'm looking forward to a question. I think I'll wrap it up right there.
Perfect. Virtual clap for Temple. Thank you so much for sharing your insights and what you've learned over your career. I'm sure we have a million questions for you. I certainly have a lot. In particular, I'm really interested coming up because I'm coming to you from Australia. We have a huge cattle industry here. I don't know exactly what the technology we have here, but it would be great to see whether you've had any connections with cattle industry here in Australia to share.
Yes, I have.
Awesome.
Yes, I've worked with a number of places in Australia, and even during COVID, I've been working online with some of your companies. You've really got some good cattle companies. The other thing, like cattle's getting criticized for wrecking the environment. I had a very interesting trip to your outback about 4 years ago. And you look at that vast area. I flew over it in a small plane, low altitude. And the only way you can raise food on the outback is a grazing animal. There's no other way. There's not enough water. And I think the grazing animal has a place, especially some of the arid land. Also, if we use grazers correctly, we can improve land. We have a lot of monoculture in the U.S. with soy, corn, that's all they raise. Well, let's put a cover crop in there every third year and put some livestock on it and graze that cover crop. We're getting more and more ranchers interested now in regenerative agriculture and doing really innovative grazing programs that mimic the movement of the wild bison, who created some of our best cropland in the U.S., and using these animals to actually improve soil health, improve the ground. I've been doing a lot of thinking about this because as someone who designs slaughterhouses, I'm thinking about, well, I hope they're going to become obsolete in the future. No, there is a place for the animals on the land when they are used correctly. And I want to emphasize that.
Amazing. That sounds brilliant and something that's very needed here. So thank you on behalf of Australia for that. I'm going to capture that visual cue and take us now to Dr. Andrew Huberman. Andrew Huberman is a professor of neurobiology and ophthalmology at Stanford School of Medicine. His research on visual system function, development, and disease, particularly in the context of retinal neuron plasticity, has been a total game changer for diseases of vision loss and blindness. His lab uses a combination of state-of-the-art tools, which are very cool, including visual reality, gene therapy, imaging and behavioral analysis to understand how our visual perceptions and autonomic arousal states are integrated to impact behavioral responses. On the side, Dr. Huberman's brilliant podcast series, the Huberman Lab podcast, would definitely recommend it, brings easily digestible neuroscience to the masses, focusing on how our brain and its connections, the organs in our body, controls our perceptions, our behaviors, and our health. Personally, I found the podcast on how to sleep better particularly useful. We are so excited to have you here today, and we look forward to hearing you once again. Thank you, Andrew.
Great. Well, thanks so much for having me, big fan. I actually listened to Gastronauts and long before I got the invitation. So I think it's a terrific thing. And also, I just want to say, Temple, I really I think your work is amazing. And I think that the many of the points that you make, I'd love to underscore them all, but then I would just repeat a bunch of things. But a couple of things that you said that I want to make sure I underscore, first of all, is that communicating science outside of scientific journals is very important. The half-life on any good scientific idea, concept, or theory or method is very short. If you have a Nobel Prize or if you don't, it is very short. And so we need to make sure that the really strong ideas are perpetuated, especially the ones that serve human beings and animals. And this is so crucial. And we can't rely on the scientific media to do that, is my belief. Don't get me started about journalists, but you just have to understand what incentivizes journalism. And it's a whole different ballgame when a scientist is talking about their work in a way that's really designed to have the public understand. It's just very different. Or when two scientists do that. So I think the world of your work, Temple, and especially your thoughts on animal wellness. So a couple things. My lab works on vision and in visual perception, and but we also work on stress and autonomic function. And I'm not going to give a lot of my background, but I basically got into neuroscience fairly young in college, and I've worked on a number of different things. So I'm interested in many things. I worked on thermal regulation and hormones and behavior, the role of androgens in shaping brain development, and then brain plasticity, and eventually human stress. And it turns out that vision and stress are very closely linked. And I'm sure Temple has a lot to say about this as well. So that might be a fun discussion. But basically, there are two modes by which we view the world and by which animals view the world. And I'll explain what this means for stress management. And I'll actually give you some tools in a few moments. So you have several what we call visual systems. You have a visual system that's paying attention to what time of day it is. And that's completely subconscious. It's registering how much light is in the room or outdoors. And that's going to regulate your sleep-wake cycles. And then you have conscious vision, which of course we call eyesight. But within eyesight, it's really interesting. We have this amazing ability, and other animals do too, to varying extents, to adjust the aperture of our visual window. So for instance, if you are really excited by something or you are stressed, it doesn't matter if you're excited or stressed, positive or negative, doesn't matter. You go into a soda straw view of the world. Your visual world actually constricts. Whereas when you are very relaxed, you are in so-called panoramic vision. And these are subserved by two different pathways. For you aficionados, it's the parvocellular pathway and the magnocellular pathway. But as Temple said, let's avoid fancy nomenclature as much as we can and just say that you have a kind of a wide angle view where you're seeing, you could actually do this right now, even if you're looking at your Zoom, you can deliberately dilate without moving your head. You can deliberately dilate your visual world. So keep your head and eyes still, and you can start to see the periphery of the room. You can start to see that you're yourself in the space that you're in, or you can constrict your visual world. And it turns out that as you normally move through life, you're doing this all the time. When you look at your phone, you're constricting your visual world. When you walk through space of any kind and you're not looking at your phone, I'm assuming you're doing that, then you're dilating your visual field. And the dilation of the visual field releases a lot of, let's just call it stress, but it's autonomic arousal. And we know this from work in humans in my lab. We've now shifted largely to working on humans. And we do this in virtual reality, but this turns out to be a really powerful mechanism for stress management that's totally covert. And the work on this is coming out soon from our lab, but this is based on work that's been done over many, many decades. So for instance, cows and many other forms of grazing animals, they have a visual system that mainly looks at things in panorama. They can focus their eyes with more detail. They have a so-called visual streak. Animals that view the horizon can look at the horizon with more specificity. We have the ability to switch back and forth. And so this is a very powerful aspect of our nervous system that links the visual system with the so-called autonomic nervous system, this kind of a seesaw of alertness and calmness inside of us. So I've become fascinated with this, and we could talk more in the Q&A about how you can do stress management using vision. And then the other aspect of my lab, I'm just jumping around here, that we're really excited about and that we have some work coming out soon on is how breathing can control states of mind, and not just how states of mind can control breathing. I think we're all familiar with the fact that when we get stressed, our heart rate quickens, or we get a kind of shortness of breath. I became interested in respiration because really what I was interested in is how we can control our autonomic nervous system in real time and do that quickly. You know, it's wonderful to say meditate or take a weekend off or go to a yoga class. All those things are wonderful. Spend time with friends. But what about modulating your stress in real time? I had a postdoc working in my lab who fortunately went on to do very well, but I saw them once during a practice talk. I don't know if they were sleep deprived or something, but literally have a breakdown in stress. Life is stressful. You don't really have the option to not get stressed before your qualifying exam. If you can, you know, some people are really even, but you have to learn how to modulate stress in real time. And so I've been long interested in this. And so what I started doing was exploring patterns of breathing that naturally exist in animals and humans to relieve stress. Turns out that the advice to take a deep breath when you're stressed is the absolute worst advice. First of all, you're bringing more oxygen into the system, which generally increases autonomic arousal. You could tell someone to do a long exhale, but then you got to inhale sooner or later. But it turns out that all animals, all mammals, we should say, and you also have a natural tool for offloading carbon dioxide and modulating stress. And that's what was described in the 30s. It's called a physiological sigh. It involves two inhales through the nose back to back with no exhale in between. So even though that second inhale is a little bit short, and then a long exhale. So it looks like this. So it seems kind of ridiculous, right? But what happens is, as you get stressed and as carbon dioxide builds up in your bloodstream, the little sacs in your lungs deflate like little balloons. And when you do the double inhale, they reinflate the alveoli of the lungs, and then you're able to offload a lot of carbon dioxide. Now, if you watch any dog before it goes down for a nap, it'll do this. It's actually becoming it's got a buildup of carbon dioxide. Humans do this periodically throughout sleep. Anytime they aren't getting enough oxygen, actually. People who have sleep apnea do this a lot. It's their system trying to recover its normal balance of carbon dioxide and oxygen. So I'm going to just take 2 minutes and then just fast forward to what this all means and what it has to do with scientific communication. So basically, I don't have a clinically diagnosed Tourette's, just to be, you know, with full respect to people who have Tourette's, but since I was a kid, I've been obsessed with animals and science and information. And so I have what you could call very, in a kind of lighthearted way, a kind of scientific Tourette's. If I learn something exciting, I just have to tell everybody. So, or something that excites me. So what happened was, in 2019, a friend, and we do something that I no longer do. We were doing these cold water swims. He's a former Navy SEAL, and he talked me into doing these cold water swims in the morning. And then it was New Year's, and he said, so what are you going to do for the world in 2019? I said, what do you mean? I run my lab. I do all this stuff. And he said, no, what are you going to do for the world? And I said, well, I want to just start teaching cool science stuff. So I opened an Instagram account. I had no Facebook, no Instagram, no Twitter. And I started doing little 1 minute science tutorials on Instagram. And that taught me a lot. It taught me that I should pay attention to people's questions, because people's questions tell me where I'm not being clear. It taught me that I really enjoy teaching science. And it also taught me that I really like drawing. I'm not a very good artist, but I'll spend a lot of time just kind of, I do these little drawings, and then I'll teach them. It's a video of me. Sometimes I'll point to the information, and it forces me to distill the information down into its simplest elements. So I did that for all of 2019 and built up a decent following without trying too hard. I did learn a little bit about how social media works and hashtags and that kind of thing. And then what happened was 2020 hit. I realized there was a lot of need for tools for stress. So I started basically giving people tools like getting sunlight twice a day when the sun is at low solar angle. Doesn't have to be sunrise or sunset, but this is how your system sets its circadian clock. Actually, a group at Colorado State has shown that in humans, you can reset. They did this with students. You can reset the natural patterns of melatonin and cortisol to their correct ways by making sure you see a sunrise and see a sunset for just a weekend. You can reset the system for almost a week. We're all really screwed up with all this unnatural light, but we need to work too. So you're not going to tell people get off your devices, and that's not going to work. So I started putting information out into the world about how people could access better sleep, modulate their stress. I avoided all discussions about viruses and COVID because it's a kind of a barbed wire topic. And frankly, I'm not a virologist. I just avoided that altogether. I didn't want to get in the mix with that, but I started doing a lot of that. And then fast forward, and I'll wrap up in about 30 seconds. I started going on a lot of podcasts. You know, I was fortunate to go on some big podcasts like the Rogan podcast and others. And I just had a philosophy, which was, if someone's going to give me an opportunity to teach, I'm going to take that opportunity to teach. And, you know, I did have a filter either. I mean, I wouldn't go on any podcast that was like hyper political or anything like that. You have to protect your reputation as a scientist, but it's been wonderful. Joe's been wonderful. All these wonderful podcasters gave me an opportunity to do that. And then at the end of 2020, my good friend Lex Friedman, F-R-I-D-M-A-N, who has a wonderful science podcast. I didn't know him at the time, but we got to be friendly in 2020. And it's an amazing podcast. He interviews amazing scientists, mostly AI and physics, but other areas too. And he said, you know, you should start a podcast. I was like, well, why would I start a podcast? He says, because when you have a podcast, then you can drive the narrative a bit more towards what you're interested in. So we started that in January 2020, and I teach, it's once a week, and I pick a topic. I talk a lot about Diego's work, and I'm sure I don't get it perfect. Here's the thing, I'm sure I don't get everything perfect. I tell people when I make a mistake, but I also have guests on. I'd love to have you on my podcast, Temple. I would absolutely love that.
I would love to be on it.
Yes. Okay. Excellent. That makes me very happy. And Diego as well. And I'm sure some of you in the audience, you're doing work that would be relevant. And so what's happened is we now have a podcast on human health and science, and it just feels really good. And I said 30 seconds, but I'll take 15 more seconds and just say this. So with a podcast, I did confront something very tricky as a scientist, and that this may resonate with you, which is I need to pay a production team, but I run my lab. So I decided to take advertisers, and I felt kind of strange about this. Scientists aren't supposed to sell anything, right? But here's what I did. I figured, look, it's on YouTube, Apple, Spotify. People get the information free. The advertisers are happy, okay? The audience gets it free. My team can produce the stuff. Everybody wins. This is the first time in my life where I feel like there's no compromise. Now, of course, the ads, maybe some people want to skip over them or something, but there is a way to do things without the expectation of doing it to make people happy, but where you're just in a give. And I think when you start to think about where there's a need in the world, whether or not it's a need from an animal or a human, and you just start to gather information and disseminate that information, just really magical things happen. And I'll stop there, but it's been a delight to get into the world of public science communication. You do get some kind of askance looks and emails from your colleagues like, hey, are you still doing science? And, I just decided to just black that out. I just figured, look, that you do you, I'll do me. And most everybody has been incredibly supportive. I think it does make people nervous when scientists start doing public facing communication. But here's my general response, which is, you know, someone's got to tell the story of their work. And I don't just talk about my work. Someone's got to tell the story. So for those of you that are out there that really care about science and science communication, don't let any concerns about that get in the way. Gastronauts, thank you for doing what you do. And I'll be happy to take any questions.
I just want to make a comment that I've had some of the same experiences, because I'll take every opportunity I can, you know, to do like, okay, to be on this meeting. I jumped on this opportunity, and I've had some of the same kind of comments. And also people say, well, why do you give away your drawings? Well, I've got plenty of consulting to do, and I always make up new drawings. And I want to get information out there, but I've had some, you know, very similar experiences, but we've got to get science out there.
Yeah. Yeah. And if you look historically at science and science communication, and if you think back to, most of the information is never going to leave the vaults of science. It's really kind of a sad thing and a hard thing to realize, but so science communication is key. And I think there are some newspapers and periodicals that do a great job of it, but you have to remember what their primary incentive is. Their primary incentive is to sell newspapers and get clicks, right? The other day I did something on gut brain health based on the work of a colleague of mine and how fermented foods eaten 2 to 4 times per day, seems like a lot, but it's small servings, that they increase anti-inflammatory markers in the so-called inflammatome. And fiber doesn't do it. So it's really interesting. Like, this is a good practical advice for people. And I can go talk to my colleague and then put that information into the world. I have no relationship to a fermented food company or anything. So there's no, the incentive is purely, this is valuable information that you think the world
I want to make a comment. Let's keep it simple. Some of the stuff out there is so complicated. Let's go back to our cover crops and our crop rotation. I talked to a really great chicken farmer this year that wanted to do it. And some consultant was saying you need to put like 50 or 100 different seeds in the seeder. Let's start with something easy for a beginner on a cover crop. Try to maybe not be quite as effective, but she'd be able to do it. I want to kind of keep things simple, where you can really do it. I find this, we're talking to parents of autistic kids. I've got to give them like real simple guidelines, things they can do.
Yeah. Yeah. Look, practical tools. Kids can do the physiological sigh. Also, I want to say 2020 changed everything with respect to science communication. And in my opinion, it changed it for the better. Because first of all, everyone now is trying to think about their health and how they can bolster their health. We're thinking about our relationship to the health of people that live very far away from us and how that relates. We're also thinking about animals on the planet, you know, because there's a whole set of theories about where this virus originated from, but it is very clear, at least with, you know, like SARS-1, that it was a civet that got it from a bat. That was the first SARS, right? They actually traced it to particular population of bats in caves. You know, there's all this question about human-animal interactions and the fact that viruses can jump between animals and humans. It's really important. Everyone's thinking about all this stuff now, right? And kids are growing up in an era where these are the discussions. There's a wonderful podcast, This Week in Virology, with Vincent Racanello from Columbia University. He did a podcast with Lex Friedman recently. And I mean, I listened to this thing and learned so much about viruses and how they work. And, you know, so, oh my goodness, a hummingbird just flew in my window and then left. I'm going to close the thing. So, because if it gets stuck here, that would be bad.
No, I had a bird get stuck in our lab when I was at the University of Illinois, and I had to take the entire chemistry fume hood vent apart to get it out. And then I opened up a window and got it out of the lab.
That is crazy. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for this conversation, Temple, and being so generous with your time.
Well, it was great to talk to everybody.
Thank you.
Take care.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Gastronauts Podcast. If you want to hear more from Dr. Huberman, check out his social media at Huberman Lab, or the Huberman Lab podcast, available on all major podcast platforms. If you want to hear more from Dr. Grandin, visit her website at templegrandin.com. Thank you for listening to the Gastronauts Podcast. For more Gastronauts content, you can follow us on Twitter or Instagram at GutBrainMatters, or visit our website, thankgastronauts.com. The Gastronauts Podcast would be impossible without the incredible team that we have here. Alam Koss is our producer and audio editor. Meredith Schmel is our theme music composer. And special thanks to Gastronauts director, Dr. Maya Kalber, and the founders of Gastronauts, Dr. Diego Bohorquez and the Bohorquez Laboratory.